Good morning, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to ISIS Malaysia, and thank you for braving the morning traffic to get here today. We are privileged to have with us today Mr. Philip Boring. I will let Thomas to do the introduction, brief introduction on our speaker today. But just a quick welcome remarks to everyone, also to Mr. Philip Boring for coming all the way here. I know you are on a tour in this region to promote the book, and the book was out last month. And here at ISIS, probably we are more known for our peripheral vision, looking, you know, looking what's happening around the region, particularly our main footprint, which is the Pacific, Asia-Pacific region. And we are also known for, you know, as an institution that always look forward, or, you know, putting a lot of emphasis on the foresight. But I think what we have not done enough is to look backward and see what are the importance of, you know, of history in moving forward in charting a very interesting, if not dangerous, you know, geopolitical waters ahead. So without further ado, I would like to invite Thomas to give introduction to Mr. Philip Boring, please.
Thank you, Dr. Hezri. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this IIAF. I'm not going to say much about Mr. Boring. His bio is in here. But suffice to say, Mr. Boring is a longtime journalist who is trained as a historian, who spent much of his time in this region looking at Southeast Asia, particularly the history and the economy of maritime Southeast Asia. Although I also understand, Mr. Boring, that you're not a fan of the term maritime Southeast Asia, and maybe you can touch on that later on. This IIAF draws from his book, Empire of the Winds, The Global Role of Southeast Asia's Archipelago, which is available for sale outside. And it, based on my conversation earlier, it took him about almost 4 years to pull off from start to finish. Mr. Boring, I think we can go for about 30 minutes, maybe slightly more, before we break for Q&A. But by all means, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much. I did actually bring some slides and maps with me, but I think probably I don't have time to go through all that because I've written a book which covers more than 2,000 years of history of quite a large area of the world. So I think I'll just confine myself to talking, if you don't mind, rather than interrupting that flow with pictures. You may ask why I, a foreign journalist who has, you know, no particular claim to academic knowledge about this region, wrote this book. And the reason is really twofold. The first, I realized that I was very ignorant myself, so I better go and find out about history before about 1800. And then I discovered that, you know, there wasn't really such a book which covered the very broad history. There were histories of different countries and different periods of time, but none of this was really put together in a way which was easily digestible. So this is what I endeavored to do. At the same time, I also realized that, everyone was talking about Southeast Asia all the time, ASEAN and so forth, and realized that Southeast Asia's concept was only invented about 80 years ago. And that there was a fundamental difference historically and culturally between what is normally called maritime Southeast Asia, but which I would call Asian Austronesia, because this is the area of Austronesian languages and Austronesian regional culture. So we needed to separate out this region, which is actually the larger part of what is normally called Southeast Asia. It is an area which owes its position in the world to a very, you know, relatively very recent development, i.e. the end of the last ice age, which inundated much of what is now the South China Sea, or at least the western part of the South China Sea, creating islands such as Java and Sumatra and Borneo, which had previously been part of the mainland. So that gave rise to people learning to sail and move around on boats, and that moved to the development of trade from a very early age, long, I mean, long before historic times, but we can just see from artifacts and designs of pottery and so forth that there was a common, some sort of common culture across this this region of islands and coasts. So here we have a cultural dimension to which, you know, to which comes this Austronesian-speaking peoples, who were actually probably there originally anyway, but spread around this region, and with a lot of, apart from common basic language, various cultural factors, whether it's pottery design or liking for tattoos or secondary burials. There's a whole number of sort of cultural markers from that era. So you already have, by, you know, say 500 years before the current era, you know, links between these islands and coasts. And for example, that the Cham people who occupied the coast of what is now Vietnam probably originally came by sea from Borneo. So there you have the movement of people and trade. So, and the importance of ships. And, you know, these islands in this archipelago have difficult places to travel around by land. So it's necessary, even if you're on the same island, to go by sea to the next settlement. Now, I mentioned that I didn't like this word maritime Southeast Asia very much, so I have to confess that I invented a word. I took Nusantara and I added an I to Nusantaria to allow it to become a slightly larger entity than originally which is known in Malay or in the original Javanese from the Majapahit era, because neither of those really fully encompass what are now known as the Philippine Islands or Taiwan, and certainly not Madagascar. So it was necessary to you know, create a word. I'd rather I didn't have to, but I couldn't find anybody who had another one, so there we were. So what are the following characteristics of this region? Well, I talked about trade. Well, you know, the first significant foreign impact was that of Indian culture, arriving, maybe 200 or 300 years before the current era, on the coasts of Peninsula and Sumatra, and that was as a result of trade. We have trade links between India and Rome, or at least the Roman Empire, which date back to at least sort of the beginning of this era, and links apparently difficult to pin all these things down, which go back to to Basra and the Syria and ancient Egypt. So, you know, we have to think in terms of linkages through trade, which have been existing for a long time, and hence the importance of the Indian extension of its trade and cultural influence to the peninsula and then around the archipelago, and leaving behind, of course, so many of the features that we have today, including writing systems and originally kingship systems as well. The fact that, you know, even Malaysia still has rajas, evidence of that. So, and the importance too of the fact that the Indian traders, they brought culture, but they didn't, you know, they didn't invade. Tamils did briefly for a while, but the existing Malay and other languages continue to be the, you know, the languages of the people and of the rulers. So, you know, it is not correct to say that, you know, just because people were Hindus or Buddhists that they somehow were originally Indians. And I think that's an important point to make, because we think about moving on to the first great trading group in this region, which was of course Srivijaya, which existed for nearly 1,000 years, and certainly for 200 or 300 years was the dominant force in trading systems across these seas. It was during this era that people from this region colonized Madagascar. They didn't just colonize Madagascar, they had a trading system across the Indian Ocean, which reached to the coast of Africa and to the coast of Yemen. So we have to think in terms of the involvement of people from this region in international trade from much earlier than is often assumed. The other thing we have to remember is that for the Chinese, their first experience of Srivijaya was a place for monks to go. For Buddhist, Srivijaya was a Buddhist center. So Chinese monks would go there to study before they might go on to Sri Lanka or to India. So, the first accounts of actually traveling by sea from China to Sumatra come from Chinese monks, not from traders. So, that's a dimension that we often forget about, because, Srivijaya still lives, in a sense, in the personification of the sultanates of Peninsular Malaysia. I mean, there is a direct historic link between Srivijaya and the establishment of the Malacca Sultanate, and indeed of others, including Pattani and so forth. So we have to think back at issues of the role of these people from Srivijaya spreading Malay language too. I mean, why is it that Malay language became the language of commerce throughout this region? That goes back to Srivijayan times. And in trade, although at times people from Java, Javanese, Mataram and other Javanese systems were more powerful than Srivijaya, at least on land, they never spread language in quite the same way that Srivijaya did. The other focus I like on trade is that we see that the great periods of trade development correspond with the success of different empires elsewhere. And we had the coincidence, and this clearly helped this region, and that was when you had the Tang Dynasty in China and the Abbasid Dynasty based in Baghdad, both having large and prosperous empires which lasted 200 or 300 years, creating circumstances for prosperity and hence for trade, and that filtered through to Srivijaya, to Java, to the peninsula, and to of course the establishment of large numbers of foreign traders in China, in Guangzhou, nowhere else much in China, but Guangzhou and Chuanzhou. But there was a huge number until there was a massacre, and so many of them had to leave. But there were Arabs, and there were Malays, and there were Tamils, and there were people from all over. The reason was that China was a huge market. It was a huge supplier, particularly of ceramics. To the rest of the region and beyond. But the Chinese themselves at the time were not actually engaged in the trade. So the trade was conducted almost entirely by these foreigners arriving mostly via the Straits of Malacca, and the Straits of Malacca were effectively controlled by the Srivijayans. So you can see the impact that the Straits had, because of the winds, the seasonal winds, which go one way in the summer and another way in the winter, both north, south, and east, west, which is one reason why my book is called Empire of the Winds, because the winds were the crucial factor. But even without the winds, it is the straits, Malacca Straits in particular, but other straits as well, which make this region so important in international commerce, even if the countries themselves are not particularly big. And the political entities at that time in this part of the world were actually quite small in terms of population, the reasons being they didn't have all that much agricultural land. They were quite prosperous, relying on the sea and on forest products and so on and so forth, root crops. But they didn't have the large plains of what is now central Thailand or the Mekong Delta. So we have a region dependent on and prospering from this maritime situation, and then after a while, of course, new people start to arrive. I mean, Srivijaya becomes less important. You have newcomers. Then you have, and I'll talk very briefly here, but the Chinese intervention in this region. I mean, I think we can see that there's really only been two significant ones by the Chinese state rather than by Chinese traders. And the first one was when Kublai Khan was the Mongol emperor, the invasion of Java, because Java refused to submit to the emperor. The invasion failed, so that wasn't tried again. And I think, which brings me to another point about, China tends to go on about tribute states. Well, the fact is that certainly until the time of Kublai Khan, the tribute was something that all traders paid when they went to a state. The Chinese, and this is in the Chinese records, Chao Jiao Kwa, we went to Luzon, they went to Mindoro, the merchants had to pay the local rulers in order to be able to trade. So the same thing happened with China. I think it was only with Kublai Khan and then later the early Ming dynasty with the voyages of Zheng He that you get the concept that of obedience, specific obedience to the emperor. So they have to send missions in kowtow to the emperor in Nanjing or Beijing or wherever it was at the time. So I think there's a misnomer from what I can see from history about what do we mean by tributary trade? Is it an exchange of goods or is it something political? And I think at different times it's been different things, but most of the time it's been a commercial transaction rather than a political one. Sort of moving on in terms of the impact of trade, obviously we then come to the introduction of Islam into this area of the world. Again, the function of traders, again, mostly from India actually, some from Arabia, Persia, and the impact was actually quite slow. I mean, Sumatra, northern Sumatra, much earlier than elsewhere. And again, you have this coinciding with an upsurge in what one might call global, it's not really quite global, but certainly international prosperity with the Ming Dynasty in China and with the Ottomans in Europe, and Europe itself recovering from a very from decline in the 14th century. So you get a sort of an upsurge in global activity, global trade, and that brings more people, more traders into this region, and the establishment on the north coast of Java of the first sultanates. Dimak was the first one, and you know, in gradual process, they took over most of Java. I mean, that, as you know, is a very, you know, prolonged process, but which in some ways might still be said to be going on. But you know, you can see again the influence of trade, the influence of outsiders. This continues on through even the, you know, you get the, and the Portuguese arrive and drive, you know, and take over Malacca, but that does nothing to stem the increased, the eastern movement of Islam into the eastern islands of the archipelago and to Makassar in particular, many other sultanates as well, but I think we should always remember the role of Makassar as a sort of successor to Malacca as the center of trade in this region, or at least the center of indigenous trade in the region. Portuguese originally came to, you know, spread Christianity, but they soon abandoned that and focused on making money. Same with the Dutch when they first arrived as well. So you see, you know, the trade and the opportunities for making money from dominating trade. And the fact is that the Portuguese and the Dutch, early on at least, never really dominated local trade. What they did was they dominated trade between this region and Europe. And that's how they made their money. But as within the region, you know, prosperity increased because there was more trade to be had, both, you know, internally in terms of the region and in terms of you know, selling products to the Portuguese and later the Dutch. So you had a period of prosperity in the 17th century, in particular, of a number of states. Port states. Srivijaya continued to exist. Aceh was had a great period of activity. Pattani was another one. So, you know, the one can see the impact of trade, which is both positive but at the same time negative in introducing these Europeans who gradually wanted to do more than simply trade, which comes to the next. If you, you know, the establishment of formal empires by the Europeans, and that was, you know, really more driven by demand for raw materials and demand for markets, particularly after the Industrial Revolution or during the Industrial Revolution. The need for tin, the need for all kinds of products. At the same time, you know, need to create plantations to grow things and so forth. And that, the consequences of that are obviously to be seen in the need for people, because there were simply not enough people in the region to meet the economic demands of the foreigners, which accounts, of course, for the immigration that took place particularly in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and we have a situation of massive demographic change taking place from a time when you had an area of the world, which was relatively underpopulated, but still very engaged in trade, and other areas, and China in particular, but also India, which were very densely populated. The situation is actually, this is a situation which is quite reversed, that you've seen over the last 100 years, but particularly over the last 50 years, the demographic picture has changed quite dramatically. That you're now about to have declining population in China. Meanwhile, you still have, you've had much higher population growth in this region. You still have population growth in Indonesia, in Malaysia, and particularly in the Philippines, and that's likely to carry on for quite some time. So the whole demographic picture has actually changed as a result of the various trade and colonialist factors that I mentioned. I don't know how we're doing for time, but I want to just sort of summarize, I think, a few of the lessons that maybe we can learn from this. The first one is the absolute importance of maritime affairs, which I think leaders here and in Indonesia both actually recognize, but it's something which is hard sometimes to do much about. I mean, the maritime affairs in two senses. One, the continued importance of sea trade. I'm sorry, if everybody going on about Belt and Road and across Central Asia, well, I'm sorry, ever since man started moving around, it's been easier to move by sea than by land, and that remains the case. Land transport may have become relatively easier over the last 100 years, railways and roads and so forth, but at the end of the day, it is still 5 times more expensive than by sea, and that is unlikely to change in any foreseeable future. When people start worrying about the threat of the Belt and Road, taking all the trade across Central Asia, well, I'm sorry, you can forget it as far as I'm concerned. The second thing about this is that we may have the winds may not matter so much anymore, but the straits do. And, between, Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia, you control all, most of the most important straits in the world. Add those up. The second lesson I think we learn is that this region needs the prosperity of other regions in for its own prosperity because, the trade linkages, which are an essential part and always have been of this region and always will be, I think, because the geography tells you that a geographically fragmented region is always going to be needing to communicate not only internally but externally as well. The second lesson I think we need to learn is that, third lesson, sorry, I don't know where we have, China. At no point in China's history has trade actually been particularly important. I mean, it's always been marginal to most of China. Most of China's trade was internal trade through its canal and river systems, big enough not to need a great deal of imports from the outside world. Many of the imports were luxuries that they didn't really need. If you look, Tang Dynasty, Yes, they had a lot of sea trade, but you know, it was all focused on Guangdong. Land trade, yes, there was for a time Silk Road trade with the Abbasids, but you know, they were ended up at war with the Abbasids, so that Silk Road, so-called, didn't really last very long in terms of linking China in any meaningful way with Central Asia or places further west. And I think, you know, we're in the same, you know, the last 25, 30 years, the huge growth of Chinese trade doesn't necessarily suggest that that's going to continue forever, that China actually may again become, you know, see itself as needing to be self-sufficient, as indeed it did during Mao Zedong's time. The role of China in international trade, you know, is first driven, I mean, the forced opening of China by Western powers. And secondly, you know, in the last, you know, since the Deng Xiaoping and the reform era, by China's need for this trade in order to modernize its own economy. And now it's got probably sufficiently far down that road that it can make, you know, has less requirements in terms of development of its trade. And also the fact that, you know, historically, China's problems have always been with its northern and western borders, not with its southern maritime borders. And I suspect that remains the case. I mean, the Chinese don't really have to worry about, you know, this part of the world, because, you know, there are no very big countries. There are big countries, but there is no sort of big empire threatening it. On the other hand, on its northern borders, it still has to deal with a very formidable Korea, a still formidable Japan, and to the west, it has all its problems, which we're beginning to see more of almost day by day with the Xinjiang and Tibet. And I certainly it's difficult to see the situation in Xinjiang getting much better, given the sense of identity which has been developed in Central Asia by the former Soviet republics, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. So that Turkic identity is something which is not going to go away and is going to be very troublesome, I suspect, for China. But that's that does not necessarily concern us here. Other lessons? Yeah, other lessons. The need of states within the region, whether they're very small or very large, actually to cooperate with each other. One of the weaknesses, and you can see this at the time when the Portuguese first arrived, when the conquest of Malacca was helped by the fact that other Muslim states, Pasai in particular, were very hostile to Malacca. So, you know, it was a sort of divide and rule. It was quite simple. States were, in the end, more loyal to their commercial interests than they were to religious beliefs. And you can see again also, because I think in the Philippines, I should mention here that something that I feel actually quite strongly about, and that Philippines is, you know, an integral part of the Malay world. Often people don't realize that. You know, the languages of the Philippines, Tagalog, Visayan, and so are very close to Malay and others of Austronesian languages. The culture is, you know, originally very similar. The problem is that Philippines has been detached to some extent from the rest of the region by first of all being colonized by the Spanish, and the were more interested in converting people to Christianity than they were in trade, And what trade they did was across the Pacific with their colony in Mexico, and to some extent with China, but that was done by the Chinese. The previous existing trading systems, which linked Luzon and Mindanao with say Malacca, ceased to exist because they turned their attention westward. And when Rizal comes along in the 1870s, 80s, when he talks all the time about the need for, we are a Malay state, we need to be engaged with the region. This is, you can see Rizal as the first modern nationalist in this region. But then, of course, Philippines gets conquered by the Americans, so they again start looking to the Pacific. I think in time we're going to see that reversed. And I think it's, you can see it just beginning. I mean, Duterte has many faults, but his suggestion that perhaps the Philippines should change its name to a Malay name, I mean, is an indication, I think, of the way people are just beginning to think about a future. And it does, mean that you should, that people can be more aware of their neighbors as neighbors rather than rivals in a political system. And that the other lesson I think of this is that these states, when they were successful, and that's you can apply that to Malacca or Makassar or Singapore today, you have to be very open, and you have to be very open to religions as well as to traders. And the openness of those states is very clearly, from all of the accounts. I mean, Malacca, for example, had its Shai Bandas, its trade, officials. And there were three for India, and there was one for China, and there was one for Java, and so on and so forth. So, the people were coming from all over. The Portuguese expelled a few Muslims to start with, and then they realized they had to send out appeals for all the Muslim states in the region to come and, keep trading. So, an open liberal outlook is essential. It's not just trade outlook. It's not just trade liberalization. It's liberal notions in the mind. And again, we go back to Malacca for a good example of that. The other aspect. To avoid, and here, I've mentioned splintered geography. Well, splintered geography means you mustn't, you have to try extra hard not to have splintered politics. Hence, I mentioned President Duterte in a positive way, but I, when people start going on about the Philippine claim to Sabah, I sort of, my heart sinks. The inanity of these sort of claims, given the history not only of Sabah and Brunei, but also the history of Philippine inability to have proper government in Muslim Mindanao over the last 60 years. So there we are. I'll leave it, really with Dr. Mahathir, in Philippines last week, emphasizing the importance of maritime affairs and the freedom of navigation for maritime countries. And Malaysia is, above all, and always has been, a maritime country. And when it wasn't just because of the Malacca Straits and other straits, it was because also, and should never forget this in terms of the origins of trade and linking India to China and so on, there's the land bridge across the Kra Isthmus. And so the history really began in, as far as international trade for Malaysia, began in Kedah,
Yan and the Bujang Valley. So that linkage is often now forgotten, but please don't forget it. Thank you.